weekend from Ohio. Almost halfway through my one-year residency program there. It's hard to believe. And yet, on the other hand, it's like, oh, I'm only halfway through. it's a long, tedious process, but at the same time, it is very rewarding and very, I think anyway, life-transforming. One of the blessings or benefits of living in Columbus, Ohio, is that we don't get quite as much snow down there as y'all do up here. We don't have the lake effect down there that we have to contend with up here. And so right now, I mean, we've had some snow, and a lot of times it gets icy down there, but maybe on average 5 to 10 degrees warmer, but sometimes that can make a big difference. And right now, at least when I left on Thursday, there wasn't any snow on the ground. And boy, I got reintroduced to Michigan winter again driving over here this morning. Although for the last several miles, it was kind of nice in the sense that it was just mostly wet roads. And, you know, we can handle that. We can even handle a bit of snow. But it was tricky for a little bit. And I told Paul I may end up being a few minutes late. Thankfully, I was like a whole 2 minutes early. So we got here. But I was reminded just in my own mind and heart this morning, looking at the snow, remembering the conversion of Charles Haddon Spurgeon. I think you probably know who Spurgeon is. You maybe have heard of him, right? My background is Baptist, and so he was a famous Baptist preacher in the 1800s in London. So, like most Baptists, he's my patron saint. You didn't know we could do that, did you? A very, very well-known, famous preacher. He's sort of the standard in many ways of all things. And as a young man, at the age of, I think it was 15 or 16, he was converted on a snowy January morning in England. It was so bad that the church he had intended to go to, I think, was shut down, and he could only walk in the snow, like knee-deep type snow, to what he called a primitive Methodist church. And even there, most of the people hadn't shown up, and the preacher, the pastor himself, didn't come, and there were only about a half a dozen people there. So finally, one of the men, one of the deacons, got up and decided to preach, sort of, you know, just on the spur of the moment. And he went to that passage in Isaiah that says, "Look unto me, and be ye saved, all the earth, for I am the Lord, and there is none else." Right? We've all heard that passage. And the way Spurgeon told the story is rather comical. He says this man that got up to speak was not in any way a preacher, and he pretty much spun out his tether in about 5 minutes, and that's all he had. But he said what he said, though, was so important. He said, our text says, look, that's all it is. You don't have to do anything else. He says, looking doesn't take much, just a simple look to the Savior, and you'll be saved. And Spurgeon said, I was ready to do 1,000 things, but he said all I had to do was look. But what was really crazy, imagine this, you know, the deacon slash preacher sees Spurgeon there in the audience, and he points him out in front of, well, all of the other six, right? And he said, young man, he says, you look miserable. I think, wow, talk about, you know, how to win friends and influence people, right? You look miserable, he says, and you'll continue to be miserable, miserable in life and miserable in death, unless ye heed the words of my text. Look, look unto me, he said. And Spurgeon said, I looked, and the shackles fell from my eyes, he says, and I was saved that day. So whenever I think of a snowstorm, especially on a Sunday morning, I think maybe somewhere there's another Spurgeon who will be converted, who showed up in a church. And it doesn't take an eloquent preacher, just somebody who speaks the word of God. Boom. It was on a snowy Sunday night in a January that I was converted as well. It was, I believe, January 17th in the early morning hours as I walked home from a friend's house. My friends had been there urging me to accept Christ. I remember, without going too deeply into the story, that I had thought to myself at the, you know, I felt like I was sort of under the hot light of questioning in the detective room, you know, they were just pressuring me. And I finally said, enough, just give me some time to think about it. But I had already decided in my mind, I've got to surrender my life to Christ, but this suddenly became such an intensely personal thing for me that I didn't want to make it a production, you know what I mean? By praying with my friends and all of this business. So I left the car at that apartment with this young lady who later became my wife, who was converted the same night as me. She had been converted earlier that night, and that's a story in itself. But I left the vehicle with her to spend the night there. It was about 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm 2 weeks away from my 18th birthday. I'm walking home about 4 blocks or so, not a big deal, but big, fat, white snowflakes coming down, you know, and the snow all around. And I remember, just as clear as day, saying to the Lord, "Lord, I'm not much. And I'm afraid that I won't even be able to make it. I feel like I'm hanging by my fingernails on the edge of a cliff. But God, if you are there and if you are real, you hold me up. Lord Jesus, save me. Make me one of your people." And I can say, you know, to the glory of God, now for 44 years, he has been faithful. I have not. I have failed him in some terribly miserable ways, but God has always been faithful to lift me up, to forgive me, and to set me back on his feet again. So snowy Sundays in January are kind of a holy thing to me, kind of a precious thing in some ways. And I hope that this Sunday, today, this Lord's Day in January, though not hugely snowing, I know I've lived in Michigan my whole life, but it's enough to make a story. It's enough to say, yeah, it's a little tricky out this morning. And I hope that God will move in our midst today. And move in your heart. Well, speaking of January, beginning of the year, I want to know how you're doing on your New Year's resolution. My what? It's already been 31 days. I know, we're a month in, and it's a cruel question to ask. It just is. It's just downright mean to ask somebody a month later how you're doing on your New Year's resolution, because the chances are pretty good. Maybe they're not doing very well. But as believers in Jesus, I wonder why it is the concept of a New Year's resolution seems to appeal to so many of us, assuming that it does for you. I think everybody wants to be a better version of themselves tomorrow. That's probably universal. And so we like the idea, I think, of developing habits that will improve this or that aspect of our character and of our life. But I think, especially as Christians, we have within us a spirit-born desire towards sanctification and being conformed to the image of Christ. We want to live better, do better, be better, right? So in essence, I think what all of us as Christians desire most is to know the will of God and to do it. I realize I've been a Christian for 44 years, so I have come to realize experientially, as well as, if you will, theoretically, that somewhere on the scale of the desire to do and know the will of God, somewhere on that scale, all of us fail. Right? But regardless, it is still our desire and our goal to be more like him. It is our ongoing resolution, as it were, to be better, more holy, to be more like Christ this year than last. Or maybe even to say as much as I was 2 years ago before this last year came and I just kind of chucked it all for whatever reason. That's our desire, to know and to do the will of God. So let me ask you this question. What is God's will for your life? What is God's will for your life? Now see, even just the way that I ask that question, you might go down one of two different paths. When I say, what is God's will for your life? That sounds more general. When I say, what is God's will for your life? Suddenly you might think, oh, well, let me see. And you may be seeking God's will for your life, or perhaps you may have already found God's purpose for your life, and you know how he wants to use you in his kingdom. But honestly, this morning, that's not quite what I mean when I'm talking about God's will. I'm more talking about it in the first sense that I said it. What is God's will for your life? What I mean is this. How does God want you to live? Not has he called you to be a preacher, a nurse, a plumber, whatever, but how does God want you to live? What are his expectations of you, frankly, and of me, and of all of us? What are his requirements, if you will, understood in those terms, God's will for you is the same as it is for me, the same as it is for everyone, all people, everywhere. What are God's requirements for mankind? Now, I know that in one sense there's more than one answer, but in another sense, all correct answers really point to just one or two basic things. Remember, Jesus was asked, what's the greatest commandment of all? He was, in essence, being asked to boil down God's will to a single statement. What does God require of us? What does God require of humanity? What is the greatest commandment? And when Jesus was asked that, it didn't take him long, I assume. He fired back, the greatest commandment is this, to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, mind, and soul. But then, quickly came on the second. He said the second is very much like it. It's like it's its traveling companion, its twin, its sidecar, if you will, and that is this, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, there you go. Some ways you can't get any more concise than that. But I'm not going to take you to that gospel account this morning. Instead, I want you to look with me in the book of Micah, and I'll tell you where in just a second. I believe that in the ministry of the prophet Micah, those two great commands that Jesus spoke of, love the Lord, love people, that those two great commands are stated, but in a slightly different way, but still in essence, they are the same thing. What does God expect from you and me? What does He require? Well, it's quite simple, really. And the prophet Micah relates it to us in three simple yet very profound concepts. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, becoming a Christian as a teenager, in the mid-70s, mid to late 70s, 1977 to be exact. Shortly thereafter, there came a sort of a group on the scene. They were called the Maranatha Singers. I don't know if you remember them at all. And they came out with this a ton of praise albums. Praise 1, Praise 2, Praise 3, Praise 4. And somewhere in one of those albums, I remember, came out maybe in the early 80s, the song simply called Micah 6:8. And I don't know if you ever heard it or not, but it basically goes like this. He has shown thee, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of thee. He has shown thee, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of thee. But to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. And then they go on and repeat it. And I half thought of maybe doing it here. I don't know if you guys know it, if we have access to the music. It is a rather repetitive song. How about if I just do what I just did? And we can look at the scriptures together. But you may have heard that song, as I did. And that song has stuck with me for all these many years. And that passage has intrigued me, especially in the last few months, for some reason. I trust it's because God is laying it on my heart. So I want us to look together this morning at Micah 6 and verse 8. If you have the Pew Bible, that's on page 1447. Kind of tricky to find the book of Micah. He's one of the minor prophets. He's past all the big guys like Isaiah and Ezekiel. But even then you've got Daniel and what's after him? Hosea and then Joel. Amos, and I think, it's after the book of Jonah, and then Micah. Micah chapter 6. Now, verse 8 is something that I want to look at, but to get the context here, I think it might be important also to look beginning at verse 6. And this will look a lot like what we just read in Isaiah chapter 1 a few minutes ago, which is why I chose that passage. So Micah 6 and verse 6, only here Micah is asking the question, with what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? You know really what he's asking? How does God want me to worship him? How should I worship God? How am I going to bow down before Him? And so he asks himself the question, shall I come before Him with burnt offerings, calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? Okay, now he's going nuts, isn't he, in his imagination? You know, actually, God in the sacrificial system said, this is how you shall come to worship me. And he was very precise, very exact, and talked about things in the sacrificial system of bringing calves a year old, of bringing goats, of bringing a certain amount of oil and so much grain. And that was how people were to acceptably worship God. We don't have the sacrificial system anymore, but we do still seek to worship God in spirit and in truth, and the way and the manner in which he tells us to approach him. Well, Micah's asking the same thing, but only in a different covenantal context than thousands of years before. And then he kind of, you know, like I said, goes nuts in his imagination because he knows that God has never asked for thousands of rams, but he's thinking, what if I were to give him thousands? Right? I mean, maybe like what we would say, if I went to church every day, morning, noon, and night, 7 days a week, would God be pleased with that? That's sort of what he's saying. Will he be happy with 10,000 rivers of oil? Oh, how about if I offer my firstborn for my transgression? Well, no, God never requires. In fact, it's the exact opposite of that. But maybe he's harking back to Isaiah. Or no, I'm sorry, not Isaiah, but Isaac and Abraham, his father, ready to sacrifice his firstborn son to prove his love for the Lord. Is that what you want, God? Shall I offer the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? And he doesn't use the word no, but I feel like this would fit right here. It should be a huge, all caps, no! You're missing the point. No! God doesn't expect you to go to church morning, noon, and night, 7 days a week, and that in itself becomes somehow acceptable worship to him. Being faithful and earning a Sunday school pin or whatever it is that marks your faithfulness to the church and to the Lord. Those things, no, this is how you really worship God. You do it with your life, and this is what really matters to him, is what Micah is saying. And so he says in verse 6, he has showed you. You don't have to guess. That's what he's saying. You don't have to figure it out. You don't have to go to the extreme. You don't have to beat yourself with whips and ropes and chains to prove your devotion to God. He has shown you, oh man, what is good. And so, what does the Lord require of you? Well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? What does God want? I'm ready to give it. Are you? Get ready, because here it comes. And it's not anything new. He's already told you. He's already showed you. But this is what the Lord requires of you, to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. There they are. Three simple, yet profound, right? Easy, yet impossible thing. Act justly. Love mercy. Walk humbly. Very easy to understand. Very difficult to fulfill. But before we look at these three things a little more specifically, I want us to learn just a little bit about the prophet Micah. He lived in the southern kingdom of Judah. Remember the time of the division of the kingdoms? Thank you, Rehoboam. It was because of him, you know, son of Solomon, that happened. Micah lived in the time and in the place of the southern kingdom of Judah. But he was alive when the northern kingdom of Israel fell and was carried off to Assyria. By the way, just a little mnemonic device, a little way to help you remember what I helped me remember in seminary was, okay, which kingdom went where? I guess you got to have the starting point. I knew the northern kingdom was Israel, the southern kingdom was Judah. Israel, Assyria, vowel, right? An I and an A. Judah, Babylon, consonant. It worked for me. Maybe it will for you. So I didn't have to research when I was preparing this. I knew where Israel went because of that mnemonic device. They were carried off to Assyria. Micah was around in the south, but still he saw that happening to his brethren up north. that had to have impacted him. Micah prophesied in the days of King Jotham, Ahaz, and here's one you probably do remember, King Hezekiah. Remember him? Remind you some of him in just a minute. But the prophecies of Micah included things like denunciations of dishonest business practices. He wasn't the first and last to do that. Corruption in government, and like most of the prophets, he denounced idolatry among the people. But you know, it still sounds kind of like our day, doesn't it? Dishonest business practices, corruption in government, and idolatry. Well, you might remember in particular how King Hezekiah was told by the Lord that he was going to die. Remember that? It was actually through the prophet Isaiah, who was a contemporary of Micah, by the way. They were buds. They were pals. They were friends. They were Facebook friends, I'm sure. And Isaiah was the one who said to Hezekiah, put your house in order, you're going to die. And Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and cried like a little baby. And I don't mean to make fun of him. I probably would have done the same thing too. And he said, oh God, please don't do this. I've been a good king. And Hezekiah was a good king. He was a good king. No good kings up in the north, but you had a few good kings in the south. And Hezekiah was one of them. And he said, God, I've been a good king. Don't take my life. And Isaiah comes by and he says, you know what? God has heard your prayer. And I imagine Hezekiah, what prayer? You know, he was alone. But God told Isaiah, and Isaiah told Hezekiah, you're going to live 15 more years. Imagine that, huh? You're on your deathbed, and you get a message from God somehow through a prophet, put your house in order, you're going to die. Oh, no, I'm not ready to die. And then God says to you through the prophet, you've got 15 more years, and I mark it. 2021, I got until 2036. Do I really want to know that? Because, you know, then it gets around to 2034, and I'm going, okay. And then I'm going to really begin to dread New Year's Eve, 2035. 2036, okay, this is it. January 31st, it's my last birthday. February 14th, it's my last Valentine's Day. April 18th, it's Monica's last birthday that I get to spend with her. Where in this year, I don't even know, sometime it's going to hit. I don't think I'd want to know, is my point, right? But Hezekiah was told that. So he breathes a sigh of relief. He knows that he's got a second chance. But you know what happened in those last 15 years of Hezekiah's life? In fact, pretty quickly, he just got stupid. He just did some dumb things. The king of Babylon came to see him, and Hezekiah became prideful. Maybe he didn't start out that way. Maybe he was just kind of proud of God, if you will, and of God's blessings. But what happened is he began to show all of his treasures in his palace to the king of Babylon. I'd be like saying, look under my mattress. I've got $15,000 saved up in here. Isn't that cool? And the king of Babylon goes, oh, yeah, very nice. Guess who Judah was carried off by 5 years later? Oh, yeah, Babylon. Connection? You bet your life. Hezekiah became prideful, and he showed off all of his treasures to the king of Babylon. And Isaiah said, you blew it, buddy. And now Babylon's going to carry off this kingdom. And Hezekiah just somehow got really stupid and became selfish and thought to himself, well, this is going to happen after I die, so who cares? That was his attitude. Ah, well, at least it'll be, you know, after I'm dead. Hezekiah lived 15 years too long. Can I just say that? That's not my message this morning, but that's a message in itself, isn't it? Have you outlived God's will for your life or something like that? He lived 15 years too long. He forgot to walk humbly with his God. And the people, too, they did not act justly. They did not love mercy. Households were divided. People drew lines in the sand, and they canceled each other. You talk about the cancel culture? That's nothing new. That happened back then. Just like people are doing today, people were divided. In fact, you know, in Jesus' ministry, he actually quoted, for the most part, he had a little liberty, but not much. He pretty well quoted exactly the prophet Micah from chapter 7 when he said that sons would dishonor their fathers, daughters would rise up against their mothers, and a man's enemies would be those of his own household. Remember when Jesus said that? He was quoting Micah because it was happening in Micah's day. No mercy, no humility, acting unjustly. All of these things were descriptive of the people of Micah's day. And sadly, they are in many ways descriptive of people in our society today. Let me push the envelope a little further and say, sadly, it even describes some Christians today. So let us listen again to the word of the Lord, as he states very clearly, he has showed you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. That's it. God requires you to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly. Now, I want to quickly look at just each of those three concepts, kind of unpack them just a little bit for you this morning. So first of all, God calls us to act justly. Now, what does the word justice mean? Sometimes, because there are different sides of that coin, sometimes we tend to emphasize one at the expense of the other. But actually, in its first and primary meaning, at least in the Hebrew language, the word that is translated justice, mishpat, maybe you've heard of that before, mishpat, it is a courtroom term, a legal term, that means a just and fair verdict. Okay, that one gets me off the hook. I'm not a judge, right? Wrong. I mean, certainly judges do need to remember this. And I'm sure most judges try. They really do. They probably try. But how many render truly fair verdicts? You don't think they are beyond being influenced? They may try, but let me just throw this out. Have you ever heard of anyone ever being sentenced to death only to find out later that they were actually innocent of the crime? Some people have actually been executed, and it wasn't found out until after they were dead that DNA evidence proved them innocent. That's not justice, my friend. And there's a whole angle, a whole realm, it's not just an alley, it's a four-lane highway that we could go down to talk about social justice today. That's important. Because to sentence somebody, just for example, and there are other ways of sentencing somebody in a way that is not fair, that is not right, and that is not just. But to act justly is more than a courtroom term. There is the idea of social justice, and I don't know where you are on the political spectrum, and frankly, I don't care. It doesn't matter. But to some people, social justice is the gospel, and to others, it's a dirty word. And I think we have to understand that the concept of social justice is a biblical principle, and when Micah says, he has showed you, O man, O mortal, if you're a human being, this is for you. You must act justly. So behave in a just manner. Do not treat or view people differently because of their appearance. Now, you might say, well, I don't do that. I don't judge people based on the way they look. I'll bet you do. I've been working on this. I mean, as, you know, a professional goal, one of my learning goals in my certified pastoral education classes, which I'm going to bore you for a second. The clinical method of learning is the idea of action, reflection, decision, and then action again. You reflect on what you did, and let me tell you something, your peers are there and more than happy to help you reflect. You know what I mean? You offer verbatims, accounts of your encounters with patients, and they come with knives sharpened. And it was my turn to get skewered just this past Thursday, but it was very helpful. Because what I'm supposed to do is to hear their critical feedback and reflect upon it. And there were some aha moments for me. There were some breakthroughs of realizing, oh my goodness, this, that, and the other. And one of those things that I've been struggling with, and I freely admit, is that I do sometimes judge people based on the way they look. I try not to. I try to check myself even when I do, but I do. And I'm not necessarily talking about the color of their skin. Hopefully I've gotten past that much as a white man. But at the same time, if I'm looking at an African-American guy and he's dressed up like a thug, okay, there's a little bit of fear there. Or if I look at somebody who's got pink hair or purple hair, well, you know, you see enough of that today. It's like, well, okay, what's that? Big deal. But then you see other people dressed a certain way, and I don't need to, like, illustrate it anymore. But you see certain people a certain way, and you go, okay, pal, you got to be kidding me, right? And then you make certain assumptions about their character, some of which may be true, and maybe they are not. But the point is that to behave justly means that you don't view them based simply on their appearance, or if they believe a certain way, if they're progressive or liberal politically, or they're arch-conservative, instead of putting them into a box, expecting them to act certain ways, behave more justly and fairly. Treat them more fairly. Don't judge them based upon even their lifestyle. You might know somebody whose lifestyle you completely disagree with, and they may be one of the nicest, kindest people you've ever met. But you never give them the chance because you've judged them ahead of time and you've stayed away from them. That is not acting justly. You see what I'm saying? To act justly means to treat somebody fairly, truly fairly, and therefore equally. So no favoritism, no cheating. Now I hope that for the most part, most of us have that one down, that if we're business owners, we don't put our thumb on the scale when we're weighing the meat, proverbially speaking, right? You know, that we don't. But, you know, and I'm not here to become too legalistic and say, oh, but did you take a pen home from work? Yeah, whatever. You know, I mean, unless you know in your heart, oh, I'm stealing this and that's your intention, that's a whole different ballgame. But I'm not talking, oh, you get a 15-minute break, do you take 17? You're stealing. I got you, didn't I? I mean, I'm not going to play that kind of game. I'm just saying that you've got to be careful when you treat people fairly and equally. You don't cheat. You don't show favoritism to somebody because they're your friend or because they look good. You think that because they believe like you do, oh, this is going to be good. No, what it means is that we are as fair-minded and as unbiased as possible, even when we are listening to opposing viewpoints. That is hard, isn't it? Because most of us, present company included, right, myself, most of us don't really listen. In fact, I've made that one of my learning goals for this second unit of study, in case you're wondering. And you can help me reflect on that too. And that is to be more of an active listener. To follow the lead of the person to whom I'm talking. And go where they're going instead of assuming certain things about them, drawing certain conclusions and thinking I have to go in that direction, right? I mean, that's what we need to do. We need to truly listen to what people are saying. And too many times, especially if we're in some sort of argument or debate or, you know, we're trying to present, while that person is talking, we're not listening. We're instead formulating responses to what they're saying, right? Come on, be honest. That's what happens a lot of time when you get into a discussion with somebody. Instead of listening and considering and thinking about their viewpoint and even perhaps even saying, well, now that's a good point. Let me reflect on that for a minute. You know, instead it's like I got to fire back with an answer. And so you're too busy thinking of responses and retorts instead of really being unbiased and fair-minded and listening to other viewpoints. Is that acting justly when you aren't listening? I don't think so. So is this for us? I think so. We judge ahead of time or without having all of the facts, and man, I tell you what, that's the toughest. That's tough, isn't it? You watch the news, which one? Oh, they're unbiased. You're kidding yourself. There's no such thing. Well, maybe they are, but they're so very unknown. It'd have to be somebody like Walter Cronkite, and even he wasn't unbiased. You know, you read a little bit more about people like him. But you can't find a news channel. I don't care if you're going to push for watching Fox News or CNN or MSNBC or, you know, somebody else. There's nobody that's unbiased anymore. And at least the nice thing is most of them aren't pretending anymore. But you see something online and, boy, you ever read the online comments when something is brought up and people are, especially if it's somebody who's been arrested for something? And remember in America, I know this may be shocking to some of you, but did you know that in America that when somebody is arrested, they are presumed innocent until proven guilty? Did you know that? You have to watch Cops to see that, right? When they say at the very beginning, all suspects are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Remember that, because that should affect how you comment on it. Instead, you see a lot of online comments. Hang the blankety blank and so and so. He should be drawn and quartered. And you don't even know the facts of the case. Is that acting justly? Is that being fair-minded? No, it is not. All right, point made, I hope. To act justly, then, means to not exact harsh punishments, even to those who have truly done wrong. Be fair-minded. So with your children, you know, I used to say, and I don't even like using the terminology, but I used to say the punishment needs to fit the crime. You don't ground him and take away his birthday because he spilled the milk. You know what I'm saying? You save those things for more serious and intentional offenses. But sometimes parents, in order to make the point, and I was one of them, got to be strict, got to be hard, got to make sure that these kids grow up right, that we are exacting and harsh in our discipline and our punishments. That is not justice. That's not being fair. In our relationships, it means that we don't exact harsh punishments when somebody else does us wrong. You offended me, you insulted me, you broke up with me, you divorced me, you did whatever, you backstabbed me, therefore now I have a right to hate you and to treat you with contempt and to tell everybody else all the bad things you did. That's not acting justly. That's not being fair. Same thing in the workplace. Let the punishment fit the crime. All right, I've said enough about that. Well, I'm sure I have not said enough, but enough for right now, right? Things to get you hopefully geared up into thinking more along those lines. So when you read to act justly, what do you think of? I hope you think, for me, that means I need to be fair. I think that's what it comes down to for most of us. I need to be fair, fair-minded, and unbiased. And really, how much of that am I? That's what I need to be. To act justly, that's what God requires of you. But he also calls us to love mercy. Now, both of those words are important. Mercy, absolutely, because it tells us what it is that we are to love, but it's to love mercy. It's how we are to approach it. Don't just do mercy. That's not what the text tells us. It doesn't say act mercifully. He said act justly, be fair, do fairness, but he said love mercy, which I find to be very intriguing. I think, therefore, to love mercy means that as a person, in your heart, in your constitution, in your very personality itself, you are favorably inclined toward the concept of showing mercy. You are one of those kind of people who are sort of disposed. Maybe even somebody might say, oh yeah, he's a softy. Oh yeah, she's a bleeding heart. Good. That means you're on the right track. Absolutely. Don't let anybody make you feel bad for loving the concept of mercy. That's what God calls us to. I'm not saying that we need to be soft-headed. That's different. We still have to be fair, but not soft-headed. But we are supposed to be soft-hearted, every single one of us. Not giving in to the punishment or consequences that somebody else deserves. Not giving in the sense of wishing that upon them, or if it's in your power, giving it to them. Ew, now it gets a little tough, but that's exactly what God does for us, right? He shows us mercy, the Hebrew word chesed. I get to show you that. I couldn't pull it all up, but that's the Hebrew word on my arm, my little tat that I got a few years ago. Chesed, mercy. Surely, oh, okay, come on. Help me out, Psalm 23. Surely goodness and mercy. There it is. Goodness and chesed shall follow me all the days of my life. Aren't you glad that God's mercy follows you, that he does not give you what you deserve? When I was here this past summer, I was talking about mercy and grace, and I'm sorry, I don't remember who it was that said to me afterward. When I said mercy is, you know, you not getting something that you deserve, grace is giving you what you don't deserve, those two different things. And someone said, yeah, they said, I heard it once said that mercy is when you get stopped by the police for speeding and he doesn't give you a ticket. Right, that's mercy. You deserved a ticket, but he didn't give it to you. Grace is when he not only doesn't give you a ticket, but he takes you out for breakfast at the restaurant and he buys. That's good. That's grace. Mercy, not giving to us what we deserve. And God says, I want you to be like me. I want you to not only do mercy, I want you to love mercy. Showing mercy to those who don't deserve it. Wait a minute, that's the very definition of mercy, isn't it? It's not something beyond mercy or a really good, nice way to look at mercy. Oh, I know, I'm going to be so merciful that I'm going to show it to people who don't deserve it. That's the only way you can show mercy. By definition, no one deserves mercy. So let's settle that right now. If you're thinking about so-and-so who did you wrong or who acted badly or did whatever, and you say to them, they don't deserve mercy, then they're a perfect candidate for it. Because nobody deserves mercy. Let me use more colloquial language. He doesn't deserve a second chance. Or how about, everybody deserves a second chance, but this person, we're talking third, fourth, fifth, and 18th chances. Enough is enough, right? I've got my limits. I'm ready to be merciful, but there is no limit. There is no limit to mercy. That's even why Peter came and said to Jesus, how many times should I forgive my brother in a day? Seven times? I mean, that's a lot. Somebody sins against you seven times in a day? About the third time, we're going to be like, that's it. You're taking advantage of me. I'm nobody's doormat. Bye-bye. So Peter saying seven times in a day was being pretty magnanimous, and Jesus laughed him out of court. He said, yeah, right. Seven, I love the way the message does it, Eugene Peterson. Seven, hardly. Try 70 times seven. What's the idea? Is that it is without end. That's what it means to love mercy. Everybody should be shown mercy. Everybody should be given a second, third, or 18th chance because we should love the concept of mercy. After all, we're shown it every day by God. Here's a hang-up. Here's the hang-up. I already alluded to it, excuse me, just a second ago with Peter's example and question. Mercy is a lot like forgiveness. It's a lot like forgiveness. It's a wonderful concept, but when it comes home to you, it's not so easy to pull off. Let me give an example. C.S. Lewis, always nice little pithy quotes from C.S. Lewis, right? In his book, Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis said, everyone thinks forgiveness is a lovely idea until he has something to forgive. Right. I know I'm right. Not me. I know I'm right. I know it's right. And I've been there. Oh, I've been there. I've preached in a church and said, we've got to learn to forgive. We've got to show mercy. All the things I'm saying to you this morning. And then when people in that church treated me rudely, I fought internal battles for the next year and a half, and I'm still fighting them today. Over bitterness toward those people, fellow elders, who did me wrong, who I think weren't very nice to me, and who I struggle to forgive. Forgive us of our trespasses, even as we forgive those who trespass against us. It's not a one-and-done deal. Sometimes you have to over and over and over again and ask God's help over and over and over again to show forgiveness, to show mercy. But we've got to love mercy. I'm not saying it's easy, and I'm not saying we don't love it at those times when now, like C.S. Lewis said, forgiveness is a lovely idea until I have something to forgive. When I've got something to forgive, when I need to show mercy, that's hard. But let me ask you this question. Will you be shown mercy if you don't show it yourself? Will you be forgiven if you refuse to forgive? What did Jesus say? You know what he said. I mean, he spelled it out in case you're wondering. If you do not forgive your brother, neither will your father forgive you. Does it get any more clear than that? He even told stories to illustrate it. So I think he's trying to make a point. And every time when I hear somebody, whether it's on the TV and I'm watching a crime show and, you know, somebody whose loved one has been brutally murdered or something, it's like, I watch those shows because I like the concept of justice in the sense of, you know, might or right wins over might. I like to see, you know, things brought to a head and to a conclusion and fairness and justice done. But sometimes it's not done. And, you know, when somebody is brutally murdered and a family member will say, you know what, I know I'm supposed to forgive them, but I just can't. I understand that on one level if a person is saying, I know I should, but I'm struggling with it. That's fine. It's like with any sin, right? But it's that person who says, I will never forgive that person. I refuse to even consider it. Don't you dare talk to me about that. I worry about that people. Even if I don't even know them, I see them on the TV, I think, oh, no. Oh, dear sister, oh, brother, what's ahead for you? And you're going to stand before God and you're going to be so self-righteous in your judgment and say, I'm not going to forgive that person. I hope he's in hell burning. And God says, how can I forgive you? Yeah? That's what it says. All right, quickly now. God calls us to act justly, to love mercy, but then he says to walk humbly. And to me, that's the piece that ties all of this together, really. And probably in its own way, it's the most difficult. Now, I want you to remember, the text says in Micah 6:8, to walk humbly with your God. Now, that helps, I think, illustrate it a little bit better. Think of it this way. Imagine you're walking down the street with somebody famous. Somebody that you greatly admire, that you think of as great. Who could that be? I mean, it could be Ronald Reagan, you know, for me, you know, Paul McCartney, you know, one of the Beatles. Some great, it doesn't have to be, you know, something that you can justify before the whole rest of the world. Who cares? It's our little secret, okay? Somebody that you really like, whether it's a pop star or a politician or a baseball player or a football player, somebody that you think, wow, I would love to meet that person. It would be really cool to just walk, you know, a block, a length of a block in an airport terminal with that person, just talking for a few minutes. Okay, you got that person locked in your head? Imagine that you're walking with that person. You're accompanying them. How much attention are you paying to yourself at that moment? I'm going to venture to say not a whole lot. You are zeroed in on that person, right? You're not paying much attention to yourself, and even though you are in the company of greatness, you don't feel like you are someone great. In that moment, you're walking with this famous person, you're not thinking, you might be thinking, look at me, I'm walking with this famous person, but you're not going to say, look at me, now I'm famous, because they're famous, now I'm great. Look at me, look how wonderful I am. No, you're not going to be thinking like that at all. You are going to feel pretty modest and pretty lowly in the presence of greatness. Let me tell you something. She's not my queen, but if I ever stood before Queen Elizabeth, you wouldn't have to teach me, except for the proper method, to bow down. You know what I'm saying? I would do that out of sheer respect for her. I'm giving something away. I didn't vote for Biden. Didn't say who I did vote for, so don't go there. Fair-minded justice, remember? Okay. I didn't vote for Biden. But I know if I met him, I would treat him respectfully. And I hope you would too. I really do. I know I'm kind of treading into, suddenly these waters just got churning a little bit. But illustration, one time several years ago, remember Jim Blanchard, governor of Michigan? Some of you who are a little older remember him? Okay, I'm at a Tiger game at the old Tiger Stadium, and we went down there by where the Tigers came out afterwards to get autographs for my kids. They thought it was cool. Sparky always stopped. One of the best men in the world stopped, and he would, but that's a whole other story. I look across the street, and there on the corner is none other than Governor Jim Blanchard. I never voted for him once, not one time. I even didn't like some of the things he did. I even criticized some things that he did. But when I saw Governor Jim Blanchard, you know what I did? I went, Governor Blanchard! Nice to meet you, sir. Why? Because he was the governor. And maybe because I get a little carried away with silly stuff like that, but I thought it was kind of cool. Now, I guarantee you that if you are with someone that you really respect, let alone someone who's just famous in their own right, whether you agree with them or not, you are going to feel, by comparison, rather modest and lowly. All that to illustrate you walk humbly with your God. You walk by yourself and you don't trip, you might feel pretty good. Look at me, I'm accomplished. I'm walking a straight line. I haven't tripped. I'm doing okay. You're walking with God. Suddenly, it's not about me anymore. It's like, you need a drink of water, God? How you doing? You didn't trip, did you? Let me help you. All of our attention is on him, and I'm not suggesting that God can trip or that he's thirsty, so let's not go there. You know, I'm just trying to illustrate. And actually, you know what I thought of when I was doing that? I was thinking of my dad. Not that I think my dad is God either. Here I am given 1,000 qualifications. That was one of my goals too, by the way. Learning goals, so you can help me with that. God has shown you great mercy. And now you're walking along with him. God is with you. Who are you not going to show mercy to now while God is right there with you? God who has shown you mercy 1,000 times, right? And you're walking with him, and who are you going to say, nope, not him, while God's looking at you and goes, really? Huh? Who are you going to do that to? Nobody, I hope. Because you are walking with God. Walking with God makes all the difference in the world. And I say walking with God will enable you, in fact, will help you to do nothing else but walk humbly with your God. And to walk humbly means to journey with a depressed spirit. Now, I know that word, I'm depressed. She's suffering depression. I don't mean depression in that sense. I mean it in a very technical Hebrew sense. To depress means like to push down, to press down. That's what we are supposed to do with ourselves. When we humble ourselves, we depress ourselves, turn ourselves into less than. That's what it means. You depress your pride. You depress your sense of self-importance. You depress your need to be right, to impress other people. All of that. It means you are a modest person. Not falsely modest, but truly modest. It means that you are lowly in your personality. Then you realize, you know, I'm not much. God has made me who I am. I have gifts. I'm not falsely modest. I want to use those. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not somebody to look up to. I'm not something on a stick, so to speak, right? I have a teachable spirit if I'm humble. I'm willing to learn because I haven't figured it all out yet. And even on those things that I think I've learned, guess what? I've got blind spots. We all need to engage in the clinical method of learning. We all need to, after acting, reflect on those actions, especially when people point them out. Rather than becoming defensive, we think about them. We are reflective, not defensive. We are teachable. We are even vulnerable. Don't let them see you sweat. That's a concept straight out of the pit of hell. That is not walking humbly with your God. Walking vulnerably. With an open, transparent spirit. That's what it means to walk humbly with God. So a person who walks humbly with God is going to be an honest, upright, and fair person, fair-minded, acting justly. He's going to be someone who loves to give second chances to those who've blown it. He's going to want to show mercy to the unfortunate and to the undeserving. Why? Because he's been shown mercy 1,000 times, and here he is walking with his God. And humbly walking with God means you want to do that for other people. See how that ties it all together? You can't really act fair-mindedly unless there's a bit of humility in you. You can't show mercy unless you've been humble enough to receive mercy yourself. God requires us to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly. That's God's will for our lives. That's God's will for your life. In a time when injustice prevails, when mercy is largely absent, and when humility has been replaced with pride, we can show the world that God has a different plan. We are a different people, a good people, a people who can and who do reflect the heart of a loving God for a world that has gone astray. Let us be Micah 6:8 people. That's what I'm asking. I know that I've taken a bit more of my time, and I appreciate your patience with me. But I felt like I need to cover, you know, pretty much all of those things. It's kind of hard to do 2/3 of something when God says 3, right? So we did that, and I appreciate your patience.